This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in 6 periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: Iran's president says Tehran and Baghdad believe that regional countries can solve their problems themselves through dialogue. A rights group says Israeli forces have killed more than a dozen Palestinian children this year so far. And Russian forces step up their attacks to capture the last major city still in the hands of Ukrainian troops in eastern Luhansk province. Hello, welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Iran and Iraq say they have agreed to work together to help bring an end to the suffering of people in Yemen through dialogue.
We believe without a doubt continuing this war is futile, as it only causes pain among the people, women and children included. This war should end as soon as possible, and the current ceasefire can be a step toward the settlement of issues in Yemen as well as intra-Yemeni talks.
The remarks were made by Raisi in joint presser with Iraq's Premier Mustafa al-Kazemi following their meeting in Tehran. Raisi said Tehran and Baghdad believe regional countries can solve their problems themselves through dialogue. He said the presence of foreign forces in the region only worsens the current problems. The Iranian president said normalizing ties with a number of regional countries will not bring security for Israel. On bilateral relations, both leaders agreed to boost economic cooperation and trade. Raisi said the trip could be a turning point in Iran-Iraq relations. The Iranian foreign minister says his country wants nothing but good for the region, stressing that the solution to regional issues would be found within the region itself. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark during a meeting with Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi. The top Iranian diplomat also thanked Iraq for its constructive role in the talks between the Islamic Republic and Saudi Arabia. Amir Abdullahian said Iran supports the reopening of the two countries' embassies in Tehran and Riyadh. He also pointed to the relations between Iran and Egypt, saying reinforcing ties between Tehran and Cairo will benefit the whole region and the Islamic world. The Iraqi prime minister, for his part, highlighted the role of Iran in the region's development. A group of Iranian law experts have assembled in Tehran to discuss the humanitarian dimensions of the trial of Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian judiciary official who's been facing trial in Sweden over alleged rights abuses. From Tehran, Yusuf Shalali reports.
unlawful and unfair. This is how these experts refer to Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian judiciary official who has been in detention in Sweden for the past 2 years over alleged prisoner abuse in 1988. Here in Iran, this group of law experts have gathered to examine the rights violations Sweden has committed against Hamid Nouri for charging him without solid evidence.
None of those who testified against Mr. Nouri were eyewitnesses. They have never been in touch with him. So Stockholm's court should have not involved itself in false accusations leveled against Mr. Nouri by a terrorist entity. The Swedish justice system is violating international law by interfering in another country's judicial system.
The suit was lodged by members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or shortly MKO, a formidable terror group responsible for most of the assassinations that have targeted Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The terror group claims that Nouri was involved in the execution and torture of its members in 1988. The Swedish prosecutor has charged Nouri with war crimes and crimes against humanity, something which the ex-Iranian official dismisses as imaginary. These people say MKO itself has committed countless war crimes with impunity.
MKO terrorists have the blood of some 17,000 Iranians on their hands. They assisted former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his 8-year war against Iran. They have committed thousands of war crimes and must be punished by the international legal systems. Yet we see that Sweden simply ignores the MKO crimes and instead accuses a retired Iranian judicial clerk of war crimes.
Swedish prosecutors have now requested the maximum penalty of life imprisonment for Hamid Nouri. The final verdict is scheduled to be handed down to Nouri on July 14th. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. Nouri, now 61, has been held in solitary confinement for over 2 years now.
Experts here say Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri follows baseless allegations made by a terrorist organization, and therefore it has no legal grounds. They asked Sweden to immediately release the Iranian national. Otherwise, they say, it could be construed that the Swedish judicial system is swayed by the MKO terror group. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A report shows that the Israeli regime has killed 15 Palestinian children since the beginning of 2022. According to Defense for Children International, the figure includes 5 children from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin alone. The report also indicates that 17 Palestinian children were arrested after their homes in Jenin were stormed at night, while 6 others were injured. According to the report, 6 Palestinian homes, which sheltered more than 16 children in several villages of Jenin, were demolished as well. The rights group says Israel continues to commit crimes against Palestinian children with impunity. The organization calls on the international community to adopt prompt measures to prosecute Israel at international criminal courts. June 26 marks the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. The Israeli regime is notorious for committing such crimes against Palestinian prisoners in violation of international law. To this day, the regime has no legislation criminalizing torture and continues without accountability to use these practices against Palestinian civilians, including children. But what forms do the Israeli tortures take and what effects do they have on the Palestinian victims? Ashraf Shannon explains from Gaza City.
As the world marks the International Day of supporting the victims of torture, the Israeli regime continues to torture Palestinians on almost a daily basis. This takes place especially when, in regards to Palestinian prisoners. Thousands of them are languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers, including women and children and those suffering from chronic disease. The torture of Palestinian prisoners had led to disabilities, to deaths, and to psychological problems for thousands of prisoners. Today, Palestinian human rights groups slammed the continuous use of torture against Palestinians by the Israeli regime, while Hamas movement issued a statement on this occasion calling for bringing Israeli leaders to trial over the continued use of torture against Palestinians. It's worth mentioning that the Israeli regime is probably the only entity on planet Earth that does not criminalize torture and actually approves of torture of Palestinians when they're detained by Israeli regime forces. The bulk of the torture takes place in the first few weeks or months before a Palestinian prisoner is sentenced. While during their imprisonment, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to daily raids, beatings, and also medical negligence, as well as exposure to heat and cold according to the seasons of the year.
The Hamas resistance movement says Palestinian missiles will destroy the Israeli regime in a matter of minutes in case of a new military confrontation. Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader, was addressing a forum in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Haniyeh said the Palestinian resistance is on the verge of victory, despite challenges and changes. He said it was imperative for the Palestinians to remain united against Israeli aggression. Haniyeh said the Zionist regime is divided and is in total political chaos. The Hamas leader hailed Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and other countries for defending their Islamic identity and Al-Aqsa. Haniyeh emphasized solidarity with Lebanon to protect its rights, especially in light of Israel's attempt to attack the Lebanese natural resources in the south. Russian troops are advancing into the last major city still in the hands of Ukrainian forces in eastern Luhansk province. Media reports say Russian forces are pushing into Lysychansk from five directions. Ukraine says Russia is bombing the city in an attempt to cut off area from the south. The capture of Lysychansk would give Russia full control of the Luhansk region. The advances come days after the Russian army took over the neighboring city of Severodonetsk. The key industrial hub was the scene of a strict battle for weeks before the Ukrainian army finally withdrew its forces. Ukraine's capital, Kiev, was also hit by Russian missiles for the first time in 3 weeks. According to Ukrainian authorities, the attack killed one person and wounded six others. As the war in Ukraine continues, the G7 economic powers meet in Germany to broaden sanctions on Russia. The latest ban will target the imports of Russian gold. Earlier, we put this issue to discussion in our news review program. Here's what our guests had to say.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the group of seven leading economies doubled down their support for Ukraine by saying they will no longer import gold from Russia. In a united move to cut off Moscow's finances, the G7 leaders announced the decision shortly after their summit got underway in Germany's Bavarian Alps hours ago. According to the White House, Russia accounts for about 5% of all gold exports, and 90% of that was sold to G7 countries. A centerpiece of the three-day summit will be the growing energy shortages, as well as rising global energy prices worsened by the Kiev-Moscow conflict. Also on the agenda are the global food crisis and climate change. Thousands of police officers are tasked with ensuring security. Just a day ahead of the summit, about 4,000 people turned out in Munich for a largely peaceful protest. There were minor reports of scuffles with police, though. The protesters want a phasing out of fossil fuels, social justice, and efforts to combat hunger. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's joining us live from Brussels, and also Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, also joining us from Brussels. So let's begin with our correspondent, Jerome. Give us an update on this G7 summit and this new decision, and how significant do you think this is?
Well, obviously, this entire event is sort of being overshadowed and dominated by the situation relating to Ukraine. And, you know, if you speak to analysts, they're questioning the approach here, and they're asking what is the approach of Western leaders in particular, those Western leaders who are part of the G7, because, you know, even you see when Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, sat down with his counterparts in the G7, he made a joke about we need to show that we're tougher than Putin and this type of language. And yeah, he was joking, but, you know, people are asking, more and more analysts and experts and ordinary citizens are asking, where is the focus on diplomacy? Where is the focus on trying to de-escalate and to try and bring about a situation where there is peace? Because, you know, this has been going on for so many years. This undermining, this attempt at provoking Russia has been going on for years. We often heard senior politicians in the United States sort of trying to belittle Russia by saying it had the same size economy as California. Well, actually, now we see what the reality is, that when Russia takes a step to, as it sees it, protect its territorial integrity and, you know, to protect its security because of the expansion of NATO, we can see what the effects can be, because the eastern part of Ukraine seems to have gone now to Russia. And also, you know, they were saying that Russia wasn't making great gains, but obviously now Russia is in the driving seat in terms of this conflict. And it's an awful conflict, of course, for the ordinary citizens of Ukraine. We're not saying anything other than that. But the point is, you know, we see now the situation with energy prices. We haven't even seen the full tip of the iceberg yet, or we've only seen the tip of the iceberg in terms of this energy war between the EU and Russia. So, you know, comparing Russia to the same size economy as California, we're seeing now we've got an energy crisis. Inflation is going through the roof, and all the while, the ruble is doing well in Russia. And, you know, Putin is also getting a lot of money in from in terms of the global rising energy prices, because he's still supplying a huge amount of gas, for example, to the European Union. So really, people are questioning the strategy of these G7 leaders, as I say, particularly the Western leaders, and wondering why we're not hearing more about peace talks.
Mr. Raffone, in your opinion, well, as our correspondent just mentioned, the ruble is doing quite fine. And now that 90% of the gold from Russia was being imported to G7 countries, and now that they're cutting that off, how long do you think it will take Russia to replace that with other markets? And will that actually hurt Russia the way the Europeans are hoping?
Well, I do not think it will be difficult for Russia to find new buyers for the gold, which can be bought in Europe. I mean, we have seen it also with the energy, it's happening the same, and with agricultural products too. So this will follow the same thing. Maybe even there will be more demand of gold from Far East because of the shifting in the reserves from the dollar to something more concrete like gold. So I do not see this as a problem. In fact, this G7 decision is a side dish decision, which it's just there to show a sort of kind of unity of the G7, which is far from being true. The G7 is a window where these leaders show their presence, and they try to coordinate on some kind of action, but in fact more declaratory than effective.
Our correspondent Jerome Hughes joining us live from Brussels. Also from Brussels, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen, and thanks to all for following this edition of the News Review.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him, and everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
The Assange persecution is the greatest threat to Western press freedoms in years. It is also a shining monument to the fraud of American and British self-depictions, says Glenn Greenwald, author, in an article published under the heading, "The UK's decision to extradite Assange shows why the US-UK's freedom lectures are a farce." Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. The recent UK Home Secretary's decision, characteristically subservient and obedient of the British when it comes to the demands of the US, does not mean that Assange's presence on US soil is imminent. Under British law, Assange has the right to pursue a series of appeals contesting the Home Secretary's decision and will likely do so. Given that the British judiciary has more or less announced in advance their determination to follow the orders of their American masters, it is difficult to see how these further proceedings will have any effect other than to delay the inevitable. But putting oneself in Assange's position, it is easy to see why he is so eager to avoid extradition to the US for as long as possible. The Espionage Act of 1917 is a nasty and repressive piece of legislation. It was designed by Woodrow Wilson and his band of authoritarian progressives to criminalize dissent against Wilson's decision to involve the US in the First World War. It was used primarily to imprison anti-war leftists such as Eugene Debs, as well as anti-war religious leaders such as Joseph Franklin Rutherford, for the crime of publishing a book condemning Wilson's foreign policy. One of the most insidious despotic innovations of the Obama administration was to repurpose and revitalize the Wilson-era Espionage Act as an all-purpose weapon to punish whistleblowers who denounced Obama's policies. The Obama Justice Department under Attorney General Eric Holder prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917 than all previous administrations combined. In fact, three times as many as all prior presidents combined. One whistleblower charged by Obama officials under that law is NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, who in 2013 revealed mass domestic spying of precisely the kind that Obama's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, now of CNN, falsely denied conducting when testifying to the Senate, which led to legislative curbs enacted by the U.S. Congress and which courts have ruled unconstitutional and illegal. What makes this law so insidious is that, by design, it is almost impossible for the government to lose. As detailed in a Washington Post op-ed when the indictment was first revealed, arguing why it poses the greatest threat to press freedoms in the West in years, this 1917 law is written as a strict liability statute, meaning that the defendant is not only guilty as soon as there is proof that they disclosed classified information without authorization, but they are also barred from raising a justification defense, meaning they cannot argue to the jury of their peers that it was not only permissible but morally necessary to disclose that information because of the serious wrongdoing and criminality it revealed on the part of the nation's most powerful political officials. That 1917 law, in other words, is written to offer only show trials but not fair trials. No person in their right mind would willingly submit to prosecution and life imprisonment in the harshest American penitentiaries under an indictment brought under this fundamentally corrupted law. Whatever else one might think of Assange, there is simply no question that he is one of the most consequential, pioneering, and accomplished journalists of his time. One could easily make the case that he occupies the top spot by himself. And that, of course, is precisely why he is in prison, because just like free speech, free press guarantees in the US and UK exist only on a piece of parchment and in theory. citizens are free to do journalism as long as it does not disturb or anger or impede real power centers. Employees of the Washington Post and CNN are free to say what they want as long as what they are saying is approved and directed by the CIA, or the content of their reporting advances the interest of the Pentagon's sprawling war machine. Real journalists often face threats of prosecution, imprisonment, or even murder, and sometimes even mean tweets. Much of the American corporate media class has ignored Assange's persecution or even cheered it precisely because he shames them, serving as a vivid mirror to show them what real journalism is and how they are completely bereft of it. And the American and British governments have successfully exploited the petty jealousies and insecurities of their failed, vapid, and pointless media servants to get away with imposing the single greatest threat to press freedom in the West without much protest at all. Free speech and press freedoms do not exist in reality in the US or in the UK. They are merely rhetorical instruments to propagandize their domestic population and justify and ennoble the various wars and other forms of subversion they constantly wage in other countries in the name of upholding values they themselves do not support. The Julian Assange persecution is a great personal tragedy, a political travesty, and a grave danger to basic civic freedoms. But it is also a bright and enduring monument to the fraud and deceit that lies at the heart of these two governments' depictions of who and what they are.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this programme, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, people, organisations and the region as a whole. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how, with rising communal tensions in India, the use of bulldozers by the government has caused widespread fear among the Muslim population of the country. And we will also head over to Bangladesh to see if the country is due to become the next Sri Lanka, as the country faces a serious trade deficit amid global inflation and supply chain problems.
The person who invented the bulldozer perhaps only intended it to be a heavy machine used in construction work. However, in India, houses, shops and small businesses belonging to Muslim protesters are now being demolished. Thus, bulldozers are not just seen as heavy machinery anymore, they are a symbol of power for Hindu nationalist politicians and a symbol of oppression and fear for the Muslims. After the protests once again spread through the streets of Indian towns and cities in early June, some claim that the state yet again did not shy away from being creative in the persecution of its Muslim minority subjects.
The use of bulldozers for violent purposes in India is not uncommon. As a result of communal violence between Hindus and Muslims in April 2022, authorities in New Delhi used bulldozers to demolish Muslim-owned shops just a few days after protests started. Once again, a wave of protests was sparked on June 10, 2022, after defamatory remarks against the Prophet of Islam made by Nupur Sharma, the BJP's national spokesperson and chief of the party's social media division. Authorities in the northern province of Uttar Pradesh rode on a bulldozer to raise the home of Javed Ahmed, who was allegedly linked to the protests. Javed Ahmed is not the only one to have had his home destroyed by the government as a result of the protests. According to Time magazine, protesters in at least three cities in Uttar Pradesh saw their properties bulldozed in similar incidents. Authorities have tried to justify the demolitions by arguing that the structures were illegal, but many netizens claim this is merely an excuse to further marginalize the 200 million strong Muslim population of the country. Millions of homes in India have been built without planning permission, and much of the construction in cities and towns in India is already carried out on illegal or quasi-legal land. Moreover, it is very common for builders in India to violate domestic construction laws. With only the homes of protesters being destroyed, many critics have started claiming that the government is deliberately and directly targeting Muslims who already face widespread persecution, hate, and discrimination in the country. India's Supreme Court cautioned the Uttar Pradesh state government against the controversial practice of demolishing the homes of Muslim protesters. However, their words have fallen on deaf ears.
Since the demolitions, police have already taken more than 357 people into custody, and families of those detained are concerned that their homes can be destroyed under the usual practice of the Uttar Pradesh authorities, which is now being referred to as bulldozer justice. The bulldozer has become a very powerful symbol of fear for Muslims ahead of the local elections in Uttar Pradesh, which are to be held in March, with the Uttar Pradesh Chief Minister Yogi Adityanath, a member of the ruling BJP, being dubbed Father Bulldozer. Now, many suggest the BJP should replace the lotus flower, the official electoral symbol, with a bulldozer for the 2024 national elections.
The tearing down of protesters, houses, shops and small businesses has indeed caused panic and fear among Muslims. And critics claim this has presented a new opportunity to the saffron-clad Hindu nationalist politicians of the ruling BJP, who, despite having the lotus flower as their election symbol, sport the bulldozer as their mascot. Some argue that the bulldozer represents BJP's fascism and totalitarianism, where even the slightest opposition is met with a crushing teardown and all voices are razed to the ground. The last decade has been stained by the pogroms of 1984 against the Sikh minority and the massacre of Muslims in Gujarat in 2002 to the protests which have draped the curtains of social harmony in blood. Ever since the BJP came to power, many, such as the award-winning author Arundhati Roy, are claiming that India has moved from being a weak, flawed democracy to a Hindu fascist state. The use of bulldozers is not the only tool used for persecution. From the sword-wielding to the violent gun-holding police officers, Muslims in India have faced astonishing events of communal carnage, where many have been mercilessly killed and have had their properties set on fire.
Now, to have more insight on this issue, we are joined by Mrs. Ridley, Secretary General of European Muslim League. Now, first of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Ridley. Now, could you please tell us why the bulldozers are being used by the government and how this differs from conventional tactics?
Okay. Well, the reason why the Indian government is using bulldozers to destroy people's homes, we all know that this has been done before. It's been done in Israel, and there is a strategic alliance between India and Israel. They swap weapons, they swap intelligence, and it's quite clear now they are swapping these sort of dirty tactics where collective punishment is dished out on innocent people. And the destruction of homes by bulldozer is a classic mirror image of what is happening in Palestine right now.
Mrs. Ridley, people have been killed by what Amnesty International describes as excessive use of force by the police. Now, has any action been taken? If not, why?
Of course, no action will be taken against the officers. This is a government which is fueled on Islamophobia. It has friends from east to west, none of whom are prepared to step up to the plate and challenge India over its human rights abuses. Earlier this year, the politicians in Washington were briefed by a group called Genocide Watch, who said that they were increasingly concerned about what was happening in India, and the precursor to genocidal actions are taking place in India. So, you know, Amnesty might express shock, but really, this is nothing new. Since Modi took over the country, he has taken it down a very dark path in which he has targeted the country's 200 million Muslims. They only make up about 14% of the country, but they're still a significant minority.
Mr. Ripley, how do you see the future of the Bharatiya Janata Party, given its recruitment prospects?
You know, I was reading up on the BJP just the other day, and the membership is in the tens of millions. The membership of the BJP is larger than most countries in the world today. I think there are only seven other countries whose population exceeds the BJP membership. So this is what we're talking about, a huge organization. And they've just started another recruiting drive to get even more members on board the world's most populous democracy, which is India. And I don't think there's any holding back of this party. There are some decent people within its ranks, but it is, at the moment, it seems to be in the control of Islamophobic right-wing nutters, is the only way I can describe their actions against Muslims and other minority groups in India.
Mrs. Ridley, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Munawar says, hate speech is achievement, protest is crime, media is court, bulldozer is justice. New India. Y. Satya Kumar, who says, after every Friday, there comes a Saturday. After every riot, there comes a bulldozer. At Suicidal says, the treatment of Muslims in India is becoming a genocide and people aren't talking about it at all. Indian Muslims are being kicked out of their homes, arrested, assaulted and murdered just for their religion. And people seem to just ignore it. At Shekhar Gupta says, strong view from columnist at Asim Ali 6, who argues, Muslims in India are semi-citizens now. Political and civil rights have been bulldozed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Bangladesh was once one of the poorest regions of Pakistan, but almost four decades after gaining independence from Pakistan, the country, which was considered a burden, turned into one of the fastest-growing economies of the world and the fastest in Asia, with a GDP growth rate of almost 8% before the land of the Bengal tiger was hit by COVID-19. Things started changing with the increase of COVID-19 cases in Europe and the US. Various brands started cancelling orders and Bangladeshi factories lost around $100 million per day and lost more than $1.5 billion by March 2020. Now, with rising global fuel prices and supply chain problems, Bangladesh is facing difficulties similar to those which Sri Lanka faced before it defaulted on its national debt. Currently, troubled by a rising trade deficit and foreign debt burden, Bangladesh, a country which was enjoying what some called an economic miracle, now seem to be in dire straits, and some even worry that it can become the next Sri Lanka.
Bangladesh was once regarded as the fastest-growing economy of the world, and the country managed to outpace Pakistan, India, and even China in terms of growth, as Bangladesh turned itself into an export-driven economy, becoming one of the top garments exporters in the world before COVID-19 shook the world. The COVID-19 pandemic has been followed by a global economic crisis across the world. The International Monetary Fund forecast global growth in 2022 at 4.4%, but these projections are being revised downwards, also due to the conflict in Ukraine and the economic sanctions on Russia. After global markets reopened, the conflict in Ukraine created inflationary pressure all around the world by increasing food and oil prices, with countries like Sri Lanka running out of petrol, medicine, and foreign currency reserves amid an acute balance of payments crisis. Now, some say Bangladesh seems to be moving in a similar direction with a serious trade deficit. Bangladesh imported goods worth over $61.5 billion in the first 9 months of the 2021 to 2022 fiscal year, rising almost 44% compared to the same period the year before. But exports and remittances, which are needed to cover the cost of these imports, have dropped in the first 4 months of 2022, causing an estimated deficit of $10 billion this year. This comes with Dhaka's foreign exchange reserves also falling by $6 billion from $48 billion to $42 billion, that is, over the past 8 months. Some experts are worried that this may drop by another $4 billion in the coming months.
COVID-19 and U.S. sanctions over the conflict in Ukraine have not only put Bangladesh's economy under threat, but India, Pakistan and other Southeast Asian countries are also feeling the economic strain. India's edible oil market and exports are suffering, while Bangladesh-Russia trade has taken a hit due to sanctions. While the economy of Bangladesh is recoverable and India enjoys cheap Russian oil without facing the wrath of the West sanctions, Pakistani citizens see crushing inflation not only because of the rising oil prices, but also because of pressure from the International Monetary Fund, which has led to the devaluation of the Pakistani currency, increase in taxes, and an acute shortage of foreign currency reserves, bringing the Pakistani economy on the brink of collapse.
On June the 10th, the foreign currency reserves held by the State Bank of Pakistan were recorded at an alarming $8.9 billion, which is roughly a 50% drop from August and only enough to pay for less than 2 months of imports. This has threatened to spill over into an all-out economic crisis unless the policymakers of Pakistan secure emergency financing, which has been refused by the IMF, International Monetary Fund. Many question why the reserves fell in the first place, and many experts have placed the blame on the IMF, the international financial institution which provides lending to countries in need. Loans provided by the IMF come with strict terms and conditions, such as those which were placed on Pakistan. Pakistan was first required to devalue its currency, which it did, and consequently saw its currency fall by 27% as a result. Since Pakistan relies heavily on oil imports, this devaluation ultimately led to a massive increase in oil import costs, after which the IMF demanded that the country remove all fuel subsidies provided to its citizens. This was set as a condition to unlock the remaining $3 billion of a pre-existing loan by the multilateral lender. This led to an overall crushing increase in oil prices, which led to inflation skyrocketing in the country at 27.82%, according to official data, the highest in 14 years. Despite complying with most of its demands, the IMF has rejected Pakistan's appeals for releasing the funds required desperately by the country's collapsing economy. Amid the depleting foreign currency reserves and crashing economy, and government forecasts of its trade deficit widening to a record $45 billion in the fiscal year ending in June, Pakistan's total foreign debt servicing is already projected to top $23 billion. Experts claim Pakistani policymakers can help avert this disaster by buying cheaper oil from countries such as Iran and Russia. But they're afraid Pakistan will face devastating consequences from the West. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan was allegedly ousted for trying to build close relations with Russia, and even the current finance minister, Miftah Ismail, implied that the country would be sanctioned if they tried to buy Russian oil. Only time will tell whether Pakistan's economy can recover.
Now to discuss this further, we are joined by Mr. Qazi Fahim Ahmed, a research intern at the East Asia Study Center at the University of Dhaka. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed. Now, do you think Bangladesh's economy is in trouble because of the serious trade deficit? And if so, why?
You know, I think Bangladesh, like other developing countries around the world, is facing economic difficulties due to the increasing trade deficit and higher inflation rate in the face of the pandemic and after then the Russian-Ukraine war. And due to the high oil price and interruption in the supply chain, import costs have actually increased drastically for Bangladesh and other developing countries. Currently, Bangladesh's trade deficit has actually surpassed its previous history, amounting to $25 billion in the last 9 months, which is actually 9.25% higher than that of the full fiscal year in the previous year. However, the export earnings of Bangladesh is also rising in significantly. Bangladesh's export earnings have almost reached its target for the current year, which is actually $43.5 billion for the fiscal year 2022. And in only 10 months, thanks to the growing global demand for the apparels and shifting of a good number of work orders from China. In April, for example, the exports clocked for around $4 billion for the 8th consecutive year month, with a little over 51% year-on-year growth.
Mr. Ahmed, there are claims that Bangladesh, like Sri Lanka, has also taken on foreign loans in recent years to fund what critics call white elephant projects, which are expensive but unprofitable. Now, what do you have to say about these projects contributing to economic problems of the country?
Look, during the last decade, the Sri Lankan government actually implemented a lot of unnecessary mega projects, like the Hambantota Seaport, Rajapaksa International Airport, Chinese Colombo City, and some unviable highways, which are called white elephants projects by the critics. While most of these projects are not that much profitable, they have been also implemented with high interest loans from China. And also, the government of Sri Lanka actually collected almost $9 billion from the international market in exchange for debt bonds, which are short-term in nature and comes with higher interest rates of almost 8%. The government in Bangladesh actually has taken a totally different approach. Here, they have taken some well-calculated and viable mega projects. For example, the Padda Bridge, which is set to be opened on 25 June this month. This bridge will help increase the annual GDP of the southern part of Bangladesh by almost 2%. And the overall GDP of the country by almost 1%. It is also important to note that the Padda Bridge actually was fully self-financed by the government of Bangladesh. According to the assessment of a Policy Research Institute, the Padda Bridge has the potential to achieve 29% growth in the construction sector, 9.5% growth in the agriculture, and 8% in the manufacturing and transport sector of Bangladesh. Consequently, the completion of the other infrastructure projects in Bangladesh, like the Kornofuli Tunnel project and Matarbari electricity project, will also boost the economy and further bring investment to Bangladesh. Moreover, the bulk of the foreign roles that Bangladesh have taken are from the multilateral lenders, like World Bank, ADB, IDB, and JICA. And the interest rates of such loans are very low, like 1.4%. with grace periods and long repayment system.
Mr. Ahmed, thank you for being on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Atpi Bhushan 1 says, as our economy sinks with unemployment at an all-time high, per capita income below Bangladesh, and India sinking in all indices, human development, happiness, press freedom, health, education, environment and protection, the BJP is obsessed with promoting hate against Muslims and weakening India. At SRGMKO1 says, hashtag Pakistan on the verge of complete bankruptcy. There is an urgent need to sign a charter on the economy, says Planning Minister Ihsan Iqbal. Steve Henker says, as Pakistan's inflation soars to 45% per year by my measure, no one knows the price of anything. What's PM Sharif's plan? Slash fuel subsidies to secure another IMF loan. Spoiler alert, the PM's program might rue IMF, but like all IMF plans in Pak, it won't work.
And that was our episode on the ongoing oppression of Muslims in India amid recent protests and economic fallout in South Asia. We will meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight. In the U.S., Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican, has vowed to remove a number of GOP senators from office for backing the bipartisan gun bill, describing the 15 GOP lawmakers as sellouts. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek magazine and is titled, Marjorie Taylor Greene Vows to Remove GOP Senators Who Backed Gun Bill. The U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican, has vowed to remove a number of GOP senators from office for backing the bipartisan gun bill, describing the 15 Republican lawmakers as sellouts. The Senate passed the bipartisan legislation late on Thursday, 23rd of June, in a 65-33 vote, marking the most significant step towards gun reform from Congress in nearly three decades. 15 GOP senators, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, voted in favor of the bill, despite a strong opposition by former President Donald Trump. Because the House is controlled by Democrats and needs only a slim majority for legislation to pass, the bill is expected to be approved by that chamber as well. President Joe Biden has urged the House to pass the legislation swiftly and plans to sign it. Marjorie Taylor Greene, a staunch Donald Trump loyalist, shared a video on Thursday, 23rd of June, attacking the legislation and ripping the Republicans who support it. To the Republican senators who are helping Biden take away our rights, we will remove you from office, the GOP congresswoman wrote. In the video, Marjorie Taylor Greene played footage of Senator John Cornyn getting booed at a Houston GOP event over his support for the bill. Senator Cornyn was one of the lead Republican negotiators, along with Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina.